Welcome to this episode of Double Jeopardy, the Law and Politics podcast with me, Ken MacDonald. I'm the former director of public prosecutions and a barrister practicing from Matrix Chambers in London.
And with me, Tim Owen. I'm also a barrister at Matrix Chambers practicing in crime, public law and human rights law. We begin this podcast with some very sad news. We learned last week that our former Chambers colleague at Matrix Chambers and a co-founding member of Matrix, Heather Rogers, King's Counsel, died suddenly. Heather and I, together with our colleague Hugh Tomlinson, we were all in the same year at bar school in 1983. Heather came top of the year. Hugh Tomlinson came second. I came a distant, God knows where, but long behind them. In order to give a proper tribute to Heather, we've asked Hugh to say a few words about her. He knew her both as a friend and as a professional colleague at the Media and Defamation Bar. Hugh, obviously deeply sad and shocking news for all of us.
Tim, thank you very much. Heather's death was sudden and entirely shocking to everybody who knew her. She was 64 and hadn't been ill, or there was no, she was due to start a trial in 2 weeks' time. And last Wednesday, she was found dead. I've known her since I was at bar school with her and Tim. She was a brilliant lawyer, as well as being top in the bar final. She had a starred first from the LSE. And after bar final, she had a stellar career at the media bar. She was universally admired and respected by everybody in that often polarized media law world. She had a strong personal commitment to freedom of expression and open justice, represented many media organizations and NGOs in interventions in leading cases. But above all, she was a barrister. She appeared for both sides in many leading cases. I just mentioned for claimant cases that she appeared in, she represented Richard Branson in the GTEC Snowden bribe case. She represented Roman Polanski. She represented George Galloway. In the late 1980s, she was one of the junior counsel for The Observer and The Guardian in the Spycatcher litigation, the famous case in which an injunction was granted to prevent the publication of the book about the Secret Services, which was ultimately overturned in Strasbourg and universally recognised to have been wrongly granted. Perhaps the most famous cases she was in for lawyers were the two cases which revolutionised the law of libel damages. There was the Esther Ranson case and the Elton John case, and they changed the landscape absolutely entirely, so that before, damages had been completely uncapped, and after that, damages were subject to narrow limits. The case which you'll be remembered longest for is the case of Irvin and Penguin Books, which is the well-known case where the Holocaust denier David Irvin sued Penguin Books over a book which suggested he was a Holocaust denier. And Heather put in, I remember I was a colleague of hers in Chambers some of the time, and she put in the most immense amount of work behind the scenes on that case. She was the junior for the defendants, and the defendants were ultimately successful, and the judgment of Mr. Justice Gray was published as a book, absolutely confirming the Holocaust and all the underlying facts. But as well as being a brilliant academic lawyer and a meticulous and extremely thorough junior, the striking thing about Heather was that she was a thoroughly nice person, and she was someone who had a natural affinity for the underdog and for those who were not appreciated in the law and in legal support. And you'd often find her talking to the most junior person on the case, or the person doing the photocopying, or just providing support, because it wasn't forced. It was a natural affinity, because she was someone who'd come from a very modest background and had done very, very well. But she always remembered her friends and the people who were highly regarded, who were sometimes overlooked. She'll be greatly missed by all her friends inside and outside the law.
Hugh, thank you very much for those moving words in the face of such shocking news. We send our sympathy to Heather's wife, Julie, and all her family and friends.
Thank you, Hugh.
So the focus of this episode is fraud, and in particular, the government's recent announcement of an independent review of disclosure and fraud offences to be chaired by Jonathan Fisher, King's Counsel. According to the government announcement, the context for this review is based on the fact that there hasn't been an independent review of fraud since 1986, and since that time, the nature and scale of fraud has evolved considerably, now constituting over 40% of all offences in England and Wales. And according to the explanation, as the proportion of online-enabled fraud has increased, so have the challenges facing investigators and prosecutors. And the scope of the review is to investigate the application of the disclosure regime and the challenges arising for the investigation of all crime types, including fraud, that handle large volumes of digital material. The objectives state that the broad nature of the review will report in two parts. Firstly, it'll look at the disclosure regime, and then it will look at fraud offences individually to decide whether the nature of current fraud offences meet the challenges of modern fraud. So to guide us through the issues, we're delighted to have as our guest Ian Winter, King's Counsel. Ian and I are sitting here together in Hong Kong, where we've been co-defending in a very lengthy, complex fraud trial for most of this year. He is, I can confirm, a brilliant criminal advocate and the perfect person to debate the current much-reported problems which seem to plague the ability of the United Kingdom to investigate and prosecute serious, complex fraud. By contrast, Sam Bankman-Fried was arrested in January of this year in the Bahamas, and his trial in the Southern District of New York is coming to a close less than 10 months after his arrest. If the Serious Fraud Office was involved, one suspects that it would be another decade before Mr. Bankman-Fried would be on trial, and the concern is that the trial would then collapse on the first day because of disclosure problems. Now, back to Ian. He was called to the bar in 1988. He took Silk in 2006. He's a co-founder of the specialist financial crime set Clothfair Chambers. And for many years, he's been garlanded with praise, deservedly, I might add, in the legal directories, being star-rated in financial crime and band one in corporate crime. For our purposes, his recent caseload in particular is relevant. He represented Tom Kolaris, the former Barclays executive charged by the Serious Fraud Office following its investigation into the 2008 recapitalization of the bank. Mr. Kolaris was acquitted in 2020. Ian also represented John Schooler, former commercial director of Tesco, charged with fraud and false accounting by the SFO. He too was acquitted in 2018. Ian has also advised suspects in relation to SFO investigations into ENRC, Una Oil and Airbus. And his most recent success was in relation to the SFO prosecution of former G4S executives who were charged with seven offences of fraud in relation to alleged false representations to the Ministry of Justice between 2009 and 2012. That trial collapsed in March 2023 due to serious disclosure failures by the prosecuting team. So that's Ian's background. Ian, thank you for joining us. Welcome to Double Jeopardy.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm delighted to be on.
Thanks very much for joining us, Ian. It's good to see you. And I should point out that I'm sitting in North London.
Yes. Okay. Now, Ian, we normally start this podcast with a few personal questions. You were, I know well, born and brought up in the suburban wasteland of Twickenham. And I don't think you came from a legal family. So how did you become interested in law?
No, I don't come from a legal family at all, and I only indeed went to study law because I was very keen on reading history and philosophy, and thank goodness my father suggested that since law had a bit of history and a bit of philosophy in it, there might be more prospect of a job if I studied law. So it's an accident, really. that I did law at all, and I had no confidence that I could practice either as a solicitor or as a barrister. But luckily, the principal lecturer down at Bristol, a brilliant chap called John Horrocks, got me interested in debating and mooting, and I did reasonably well at that. So I thought I'd have a pop at the bar, and luckily that seems to have gone reasonably well.
Yeah, I think it has. And why crime? What, I mean, was it crime from the beginning?
Yeah, always crime. And I applied for six civil sets, got no offers at pupillage. Applied for six criminal sets, got six offers at pupillage. So I thought, well, maybe I'd be better off doing criminal law.
So it wasn't something that you'd been aiming for from the start, like some of our guests. Some of our guests seem to have a pretty clear idea when they start what sort of law they want to do. Yours was a little more random than that.
Yeah, totally random. I had no confidence that I'd be able to be a barrister at all. So it was really a case of trying. And when I couldn't do civil, I went into crime and immediately found that it was the right thing for me. I mean, I immediately loved it from the start. And luckily, I had some very good training at the old QEB, for which I'm very grateful.
Now, I happen to know that as well as being a brilliant barrister, you were also a fantastic sax player. And you've also recently taken up wine, growing wine and olive oil. Which is the most important aspect of life?
I think playing jazz tenor saxophone is definitely the most important, although I'm equally very, very lucky that I didn't try and make a living out of it. I think looking back on it, I'm very glad I came to the bar.
Okay, well, look, we're here to talk about fraud, in particular this fraud review. And can we just start with your thoughts on the SFO generally? I mean, it was created in 1987, some years ago, after the Roskill report, which was 3 years in the making and set up this unique body which would combine investigative skills, prosecutors, and expert accountancy. But more recently, we've heard complaints that fraud cases are complex and document heavy. What's your thinking about that?
Well, I think when it was created, there was quite a lot of excitement that this was going to be an extremely effective body that would have this unique combination of power that would enable it to get to the heart of what the problem was and focus the prosecution where the evidence was strong. And I think in the first years, it did demonstrate that it did have real teeth, and therefore it is a bit surprising to hear people say that fraud cases are complicated and document heavy. Everybody knows that. But they've got the weaponry to deliver. So I don't think they lack the powers. They may lack some of the right staff, but they've definitely got the right powers. And when they put it together properly, they've obviously had, over the years, many notable successes. Unfortunately, they've also had a lot of very serious failures.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because this model of investigators and lawyers working together broke one of the great taboos of the bar. I mean, I remember when we started, and certainly during the 80s, early 80s, the idea of barristers working side by side with any other professionals was an absolute no-no. We were supposed to be these rather Olympian, independent figures sitting on the mountaintops, surveying the case and controlling the case and being beholden really to no one but our own professional judgment. So it was quite a revolutionary model. And I think the bar slightly resistant to it at the start. I mean, do you get the sense that in the early years, the investigators and lawyers were working together effectively, or were there still, even within the organization, some barriers between them? I mean, between the in-house lawyers and the investigators.
Well, I think at the beginning, I mean, you're absolutely right, Ken, that there was a lot of surprise when they revealed it, but also quite a lot of excitement. And I think in the early years, the SFO instructed really outstanding practitioners. I mean, one has in mind John Matthew in the original Guinness trial. When you're using people of that caliber, I really can't imagine there was any difficulty between the independent barristers and the in-house lawyers. I mean, I know people who were prosecuting on that team, and they were really excited and enthused by what was happening at that time. And the team they put together was extremely effective. And I think over the years, there's been an increasing reluctance on the part of the SFO to fund that. And they have struggled, I think, to find people who may have the correct level of expertise in fraud case.
Well, the trouble is, I think they can't afford it. I mean, I don't know what sort of fee John Matthew was charging in that case, but probably well below his commercial fee. I mean, I think this is one of the issues that I wanted to raise with you, Ian, because I think one of the fundamental problems we have with our prosecuting agencies, and it may be insoluble, is the whole concept of a divided profession where the agencies themselves are seen as sort of instructing solicitors and they bring in outside barristers to prosecute their cases. And I think one of the problems with that is that it makes the role of a lawyer inside one of those agencies rather limited, in the sense that they're not traditionally expected to do advocacy, although we tried to develop some advocacy in the CPS when I was DPP. And this makes the job far less attractive to the most able practitioners. I mean, there must be a reason why in the United States, the best graduates from Harvard Law School go off to join the US Attorney's Office for a few years before going into private practice, or to a quality DA's office before going into private practice, in a way that doesn't happen, certainly with the SFO or the CPS. And I think that's a problem at the heart of all this. It's a question of the personnel, what their jobs are, what their ambitions are, what their horizons are, and the extent to which they're being limited by their remit into a rather narrow form of legal work.
I think you're absolutely right about that. I'm not sure that it's really very realistic to change that. I can't imagine you could create a similar system to that which operates in America. Here is a real problem. You're absolutely right. I mean, they seem to me to be very demotivated. They see themselves as very much a sort of second class level of lawyer. I think the independent bar, frankly, largely regards them in that way. And therefore, I don't think you have now the sort of bonding in the team which produces a coherent corporate decision-making process, and there's difficulties between the individual elements in those teams. And certainly from what I've seen looking at it from the defense perspective, they're not very happy teams and they don't seem to fire very effectively.
And I think that's right. I think there's a great deal of demotivation, but it always seemed to me, I mean, when I went to the CPS from the outside bar when I became DPP, it always seemed to me that the only way to resolve that would be to create a cadre of advocates within these organizations so people could join as trainee advocates, become advocates, present their own cases in court, so that you then had a whole team on a case with an in-house advocate, whether it was in the CPS or the SFO, and that would drive motivation, would drive the desirability of the job. And we did notice when we started to create a cadre of Crown advocates in the CPS, we noticed it was quite noticeable that the quality of people and the seniority of people wanting to join increased quite dramatically. Now, the policy wasn't particularly favored by Keir Starmer when he came after me, and so it rather fell into abeyance. And I know it was very unpopular at the bar, but I do think it's a fundamental issue, this, that if you don't offer people real criminal legal careers, which must include advocacy, you're going to struggle to attract the best. So I'm not sure you're right that you couldn't reintroduce the US model. I think it's just a question of will. And it may be the bar in England and Wales is too powerful to allow it to develop, but I still think it's the best solution.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because a very little known fact is that before I joined Chambers to do a pupillage, I worked for the CPS for about 8 months as an in-house prosecutor in that very narrow window where they permitted you to appear in court without having done a pupillage. And so it was enormously valuable to me to be able to appear at Marylebone Magistrates Court 5 days a week and get a lot of experience before I then went and did a pupillage. And I think I don't think it's a particularly good idea to permit people to appear in court without having done a pupillage. So I think it was right that that got changed. But if you were to have people going in there and being exposed to full advocacy activity, then you will definitely enthuse and give a much more exciting career path for people who might think that's actually a rather more enjoyable way of doing things than coming to the risky state of the independent bar.
I mean, while we're on the subject of resources and the quality of personnel who the SFO are recruiting, there have, of course, in the last few years been two major reports into the collapse of two cases, the Uniroyal case and the Serco case. And the report into the collapse of the Serco case by Brian Altman, King's Counsel, reveals a truly extraordinary dysfunctional arrangement in terms of the way in which the SFO Recruits Disclosure Council and Disclosure Review Council. And in one section, he deals with the daily rates that are being offered to recruit barristers to come and do this vital task of disclosure. And I mean, the daily rate is £250 a day based on a 7-hour day. So that's about £35 an hour. And he describes a situation in which, you know, it became difficult for the SFO to actually recruit enough barristers to come and do the job. So, I mean, is this, based on your extensive experience now of at least four major SFO prosecutions in the last few years, I mean, is that something that cries out to you as just fundamentally dysfunctional?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in G4S, the prosecution needed to ask for an entire year's adjournment of the trial, which was already 9 years old. In order to try and get on top of the disclosure situation, and failed to do so in an entire year, partly because of their failure to deal properly with the computerized systems that operate on the disclosure, but also they simply could not attract enough disclosure juniors because of the rates they were paying. And nobody is interested in that type of really difficult work at those rates. And they just weren't in a position to offer any more. And the judge was trying to encourage them to pay a bit more. But I assume the way they're structured means it's just not available to them.
Well, let's move on to some of these cases that you're involved with. Because I know from discussions with you that one of your central conclusions about each of these cases, why they all went wrong from the point of view of the prosecuting authority, is that the cases or the investigations began with a failure by the Serious Fraud Office to really understand the case and to work out what the case theory was. This in turn then fed into disclosure disasters, which led finally to the collapse or the acquittal in each case. But can we just go through some of these cases and get you to explain briefly, perhaps, because I know they're complex cases, what went wrong and why this issue of case theory is so important? Can we start with Tesco?
Yes, of course. And perhaps I'll just say at the outset that I think, in a sense, the name unused material is misleading. Because there is only material when you start investigating a case.
And just for listeners who may not be familiar with this, what is unused material? What are we talking about there?
Well, the unused material is the material that the prosecution has chosen not to use as part of its case, that then has to be reviewed and disclosed if it undermines the prosecution case or assists the defense case. But my point is that you need to go back a stage before it becomes unused material, because at that point in time, it's just the material in the case. And therefore, to view this in this rather strange way, I think is wrong. And I think what needs to happen is that all the material in the case that's obtained and secured by the SFO needs to be mastered, which means you need to put it in chronological order and you need to understand what it establishes. And it's only when you understand what happened day to day going forward that you've got a chance of identifying the correct case theory about what the nature of the crime is. And my view is that it's really that failure that drives the essential failures of these cases, but also gives rise to the wrongful categorization of material as unused, when in many cases it is in fact what ought to be at the heart of what happened in the case. Now, in Tesco, there was an underlying fraud that wasn't ever investigated. So there were little people in the bottom of Tesco who were pulling forward revenue and recognizing the revenue in a period earlier than perhaps it should have been, which on occasion was fraudulent and on occasion was legitimate, but for certain accounting reasons. And when that came up to the higher level of the case, the SFO decided to rely on the chief Tesco accountant as a witness of truth, when he was really the gateway from the underlying fraudulent activity up to the corporate level activity of the defendants and indeed Tesco. But they called him as a witness of truth, he not having pleaded guilty to any fraud or being immunized. And of course, it was relatively easy in cross-examination to explain that most of the documents they relied on written by him weren't fraudulent documents, because obviously, not having pleaded guilty, he explained that this was all perfectly lawful. Whereas a correct case thesis would have looked at where the actual fraud was in the underlying pulling forward of receipts and invoices, so as to recognize them too early, and that would have permitted the case to proceed on a correct factual base.
So in essence, what you're saying is that they had a case theory, but they had the wrong case theory. But I'm interested in your remarks about unused material. I mean, what happens is the investigators gather together a bulk of material. It's then assessed. Some of it the prosecution decide to use to prove their case. The rest is the unused material, which has to be considered so that a decision can be made whether that material has a tendency to undermine the prosecution case or to assist the defense. And if it falls into either of those categories, it has to be disclosed. I mean, it must be that at some stage, I assume, before the SFO creates a case theory, all of the material has been considered, because they have to make the selection of what material they're going to use and what material they're not going to use. So there is at some stage an assessment of all the material. It's just that the unused material doesn't fit the case theory which the SFO favors at that time. But that's an inevitable process, isn't it? But at some point, they have to draw stumps and say, this is what we think the case is. We'll use this material. We're not going to use that material. Subsidiary question, does that material undermine us or help the defense if it does disclose it? But that's an inevitable process, isn't it?
Well, it is. But if you get the right case theory, you shouldn't have any material that undermines it, or there wouldn't be very much that undermines it. I mean, for example, in G4S, the actual activity was alleged to be booking false expenses so as to inflate the amount of cost in the contract so it looked like they were making less profit than they actually were. That requires a mastery of the underlying books and records that will prove what costs were and weren't or weren't actually incurred and where they were incurred. And G4S had a USA subsidiary that was providing a lot of the work for the company. And the SFO never mastered the actual underlying material so as to build the case from the bottom up, so as to be able to prove what expenses had actually been incurred and which ones hadn't been. What they did was to try to go from higher level, in fact, hearsay analysis in models and management documentation, to try and avoid the difficulty of mastering the underlying material. Now, imagine that they ended up getting the underlying material, which is partly why the case collapsed in the end. If your case thesis is that these expenses have not been incurred, but there you are, you've got underlying material showing that they have been incurred or showing that they've been incurred in the USA, that's obviously a disclosable thing. But why have you brought a case based on that thesis if the material renders it false? And what I'm saying is you ought to understand all of the material at the outset so you know exactly what is the correct case theory. And that, by necessity, ought to mean that you don't have very much unused material to disclose.
Let me put to you, Ian, what Sir David Calvert-Smith said in his report, because it reflects very much what you're saying. And in a sense, it's so obvious that you just wonder how on earth a different approach could ever have been taken. So he was appointed, as you know, to look at the collapse of the Unaroyal case. And it collapsed for a number of reasons, but it also included disclosure. And he said the key lessons emerging from the disclosure process, as it is managed in the SFO in general, and as it was applied in this case, can be summarized as follows. All material obtained during the course of an investigation should be contemporaneously recorded and promptly considered throughout the life of the case so that an informed decision can be made whether to charge a suspect, and if so, what with. And makes the point that the SFO has the advantage that since it combines the function of investigation and prosecution in one organization, it has, by definition, all such material within its possession. And then secondly, he says, The decision to charge will be made on the basis of all the available material, that which supports the evidence of guilt and that which may point away from it. At that stage, therefore, the latter material, in other words, the material that points away from guilt, should already be being scheduled for disclosure, if not part of the evidence served for trial. After charge, the process of gathering or receiving material will continue. The scheduling process begun during the investigation phase must continue so that the process of preparing for the case to go to trial can be properly undertaken and any new material added to it. And then he says this: it should never be the case that the investigative arm of a prosecution body like the SFO has within its possession material which is potentially relevant and or disclosable, of which the case team is unaware and to which the case team does not have access. Now, I mean, that seems so obvious, doesn't it?
Well, it does to me, and it is really what I'm saying, that you really oughtn't to have a significant body of unused material that destroys or damages the used material. That ought to be raising question marks in the prosecution case team as to whether the allegation's right. And that's an important decision that needs to be made, informed by that underlying material. And just to add one point, what sometimes happens is that the wrong case thesis is determined by a witness who says to the investigator a particular story, and they run with the witness because I think there is an inclination at the SFO to prefer oral testimony over what was written at the time. And I am very strongly of the view that the true witnesses in a fraud case are the documents, because they are the things that were created at the time. They are the flies on the wall, literally at the time that the things were being said. And they are the real witnesses. And to try to call in a fraud case an oral testimony that is not backed up by the documents is very, very dangerous. And you can really destroy a witness by using what he wrote or what was written to him at the time, inconsistent with what he's then saying.
Yeah.
Well, that's absolutely right. And when you're defending, it's always, of course, an enormous pleasure to have a document like that sort of that sort in your hand when you're cross-examining some hapless witness who's struggling to remember it and doesn't really have an answer to it. I think one of the problems here, Ian, is this. I mean, you're absolutely right that it's a bizarre situation if the prosecution are bringing a case when it has in its possession unused material that demonstrates that its case doesn't work. The problem here may be that in some circumstances there simply isn't a case theory consistent with guilt on a proper understanding of the papers. But either that isn't understood by people within the prosecuting agency, or rather worse, they simply want to press on anyway because the case has started and it takes on a life of its own and there have been preliminary hearings and everyone's going to feel a bit embarrassed and foolish to drop it. And it's just a kind of lethargy around making the decision. And we've all been in cases where we've just been immensely frustrated that the prosecution just won't make the decision, which everybody can see they're inevitably going to have to make in 3, 4, 5, 6, 2 years time. So there's that factor as well, isn't there? It's not just about competence. It's also about having the guts, if you're a prosecutor, to know when the game's up.
I couldn't agree more with that. And indeed, the Barclays is a very, very good example of that, because the prosecution thesis in that case was that Barclays and Qatar had entered into a sham contract to disguise the payments of the fees that they said had in fact been paid to get Qatar to participate in the 2008 capital raisings, but which were said to be payments for advisory services. That was the critical error the SFO made, was to think that they were shams. They hadn't investigated in Qatar. They had no information about what the Qataris had done or hadn't done. But they did know that all of the bank's internal lawyers and its external lawyers had advised at the time that whilst the contract was indeed a mechanism to transfer money to Qatar, it was lawful and therefore not a sham as long as Qatar agreed to provide these advisory services. And the problem really was that once it became clear that that was a serious legal error, it wasn't a sham, they didn't confront it. And the original trial judge ruled there was no case to answer because it wasn't a sham. The Court of Appeal said there was a case to answer, but still they wouldn't deal with this essential problem. And as a result, whilst it went to a jury, the jury were out barely overnight because it was dependent, in fact, on it being a sham. And in law, it wasn't. And it's a bit surprising that a body such as the SFO doesn't have the ability to look at their decisions critically and, where they've got them wrong, deal with it.
Can we move on now then to the role of deferred prosecution agreements? Because in many of these cases, which have ended in failure, if you want to call it that, from the point of view of the prosecutor, in failure of prosecuting individual defendants for serious fraud, those prosecutions of individuals have taken place against the background of a court-approved deferred prosecution agreement with the corporate entity for which the individuals once worked. Now, the DPA, or Deferred Prosecution Agreement, system was introduced by legislation some years ago, and in effect, it enables a corporate entity to avoid being criminally prosecuted on the basis of accepting that fraudulent conduct had occurred and demonstrating that the company has effectively changed its entire approach. But it leaves open, and then there's a deferral of a decision approved by a judge following an open court hearing, which enables the corporate entity not to be immediately prosecuted. So it has huge benefits for the corporate. There then has followed, in many of these cases, as we say, prosecution of individuals, and you've been involved in these cases which have then ended in failure. So the question is this critical problem that you've identified of a failure to grasp the case theory linked to the desire to do, if you like, an initial agreement with the corporate, with the consequences they may follow in with confiscation orders and so on, and then to fail to realise that the individual prosecutions simply don't work?
Oh, absolutely. And I think the DPA process exacerbates the problem we've been discussing in the last half an hour or so, because the DPA process is a horse-traded process, frankly, between the SFO and the company to arrive at a factual basis upon which the deferred prosecution agreement will be based. And it's then taken before a court, and the court is not being asked to determine whether that agreement is properly based evidentially. They are really taking it at face value because it's an agreement that's already been reached. And therefore, that process will have the company, whose financial interests are right at the heart of this, negotiating a factual basis for the agreement that they won't be prosecuted. And that obviously limits the amount that they will have to pay by way of fine. And so it cements the wrong case thesis in fact, at the insistence or the desire of a company whose personal interests are right at the heart of it. And to do that first and to give that process precedence over the prosecution of individuals, it seems to me to be fraught with danger. And we know that the SFO is, understandably in one sense, very keen at the success it's had in getting DPA awards, because in its 2022 annual report, it sets out the very large, impressive sums that they've managed to collect from those companies. That's all well and good. But if the consequence is you then prosecute the human defendants on a completely flawed case thesis, resulting in those prosecutions collapsing, that is a terrible situation, I think, to be in, and will remove the deterrent effect that the criminal law ought to have on the directors who are causing the companies to commit the offences in the first place.
I mean, there's clearly a problem here. Let me just say a couple of words in defence of DPAs from the prosecutor's point of view, or I suppose more accurately, the state's point of view. I mean, in very, very complex cases involving corporates, cases which could be extremely difficult to unravel in forensic court proceedings, they're quite a good device. I mean, they put a stop to the conduct. They recover very, very substantial sums. We're talking about tens, hundreds of millions. And they're an important public statement. So I think they can work. They're very widely used, of course, in the United States. And I know that Edward Garnier, who, when he was Solicitor General, introduced these measures, was quite impressed by the way they worked in the United States. The problem comes, as you say, in where the corporate, the big guys, get a deal, which doesn't personally cost them anything, frankly, the people who are involved at some levels, although it costs the corporate a lot of money. But other people find themselves facing prosecution. And I must say, I agree with you to this extent, that if the prosecution are going to bring a case against individuals, it must be surely strictly on the basis that was agreed as part of the DPA. And if they deviate from that at all, that would seem to be grossly unfair. And if they're obliged to deviate from it at all, they shouldn't do it. Because it seems to me that the inconsistency between a case brought against an individual and a case brought against the corporate is sufficiently a damning circumstance to damn the prosecution of the individuals.
I completely agree. And also what's happening at the moment is we're ending up with frankly, an absurd situation. And for example, in Tesco, the DPA agreed that a fraud had been committed in a sum of more than £200 million. And the prosecution ultimately fail to present a case to answer of any fraud at all. And so you've got Tesco paying over a very large fine, and then it being revealed when you actually look at the evidence that no corporate fraud had occurred at all. I mean, if there was a fraud at the very bottom.
Perhaps Tesco should be asking for their money back.
then so should G4S, yeah. Because the G4S paid fine in tens of millions of pounds.
Do you think there's a case for saying, Ian, that in situations where, I mean, they don't always prosecute individuals. I think after Rolls-Royce, they took the rather politic decision not to go after individuals. And it might have been quite embarrassing if they had, given the status of Rolls-Royce in the British economy. But do you think there's a case for saying that when they agree DPAs with the corporate, that the individuals ought to be wrapped up in that DPA in some reason? That would be a much fairer way of proceeding.
I think that would be a much fairer way of proceeding, or alternatively, prosecute the individuals first. It doesn't seem to me to be right to give precedence to a commercial deal, frankly, over the individual, the state of the individuals. And if the individuals have done something criminal, then they ought to be prosecuted first, and dependent on the fraud then proved, you then do the DPA with the company, which I think has happened on occasion. But the trend lately is to get the money out of the corporates. And if that comes at the price of not getting the individuals, then that's a price worth paying. But I'm not certain as a society that is the right price, because as you rightly point out, the DPA fine is normally paid either by the corporate or very often by the shareholders of the corporate, who won't get dividends.
Yeah.
And you're not deterring the crime being committed in the first place if the individual directors know that there's very little chance that they'll be convicted.
Well, look, against that background of critique of the current system, let's look at how this review that's just been announced is going to work. David Corker, who's, as we all know, a highly experienced solicitor in the field of financial crime, wrote an excellent article in the Times last week, in which he made the point that this review is essentially a one-man band comprised of Jonathan Fisher, KC, in contrast to the previous major review which set up the SFO, the Roscoe Report, which was led by an appellate judge leading a team of seven eminent lawyers, as David says, each representing a different constituency within the criminal justice system. He makes the point that the Attorney General has asked for a rapid response. In other words, within 9 months, Jonathan Fisher is supposed to deliver his thoughts about the current disclosure regime, which has been the cause of all of these massive problems. And he makes the point that the Roscoe Report took 3 years to accomplish its task. And David Corker says that the danger is that by agreeing to labour under such solitary and austere conditions, Jonathan Fisher will tread a shallow path, that there will be neither time nor opportunity to consider fundamental questions, with the priority being his recommendation of supposedly quick and pragmatic solutions. And he warns, says David Corker, that superficiality is a massive danger in relation to this disclosure issue, and that devising a fair disclosure regime in a digital era within an adversarial method of litigation is a major challenge. Now, David's conclusion, which actually chimes with what Claire Montgomery, KC, our Chambers colleague, said when she was on the podcast some months ago, David Corker's conclusion is the same, actually. He says that it's time to be audacious by asking whether the law took a wrong turn in 1997 by placing the disclosure burden on the prosecution. He says it did. The chief casualty of the mistake is the Serious Fraud Office. And he says the answer is not to compromise fair trial rights, but rather to put responsibility for disclosure where it is best placed on the defence. Now, that sounds absolutely right. If you're looking at it certainly from a defence point of view, why would you not want to be in control of the reviewing process of the unused material? But is it practical?
No, I don't think it is, I'm afraid. And I obviously have the temerity to disagree with those two very eminent people whose views I obviously respect enormously. But I remember before 97 when there was defense involvement in the disclosure exercise, in fact, where this criticism of giving away the keys to the warehouse comes from, it did result in a lot of defense people sitting in very large warehouses for very, very lengthy periods of time. And I don't think that's the answer. I don't think it is an answer just to let people wallow from either side of the criminal process in the quantity of this material. Then there needs to be focus. From the prosecution, there needs to be focus on the correct case thesis. And from the defense, there needs to be focus on what it is that the prosecution's not aware of, that they need to be given in order to have a fair trial. And what's really occurring here is noted in the scope of the Fisher review, that part of the focus will be on what to do given these very large volumes of digital material. Mm. And my concern is that there will be a looking at whether we can move to restrict the amount of material by narrowing the disclosure test, when I don't think that is the answer. I think technology is the answer. And I can give you the example from G4S, because G4S, the SFO, had an antiquated software system that was not fit for purpose, frankly, which they didn't understand how it worked. I mean, they didn't understand that the computer system saw certain punctuation as being a letter, so that if you were searching for the word fraud, for example, it would return a document that had the word fraud in it, but would not return that document if it had the word fraud followed by a full stop. Sure. And since a lot of the emails in this case were Ian Dot Winter type emails, it became clear that very large quantities of materials hadn't returned to the search tests. And when this came to light, it was obviously a disaster and meant they had to do quite a lot of the material again. And they then outsourced this to an outsource company who turned round what the SFO had failed to do in years in a matter of a few months. Now, it's obvious, therefore, if you use the correct AI, you can cut through the quantities of material that will narrow, not on a disclosure test basis, but on a quantity basis. And that, I think, is the way forward. And if you've got the prosecution with the correct case thesis, that the defense won't be asking for very much material. If the case is in the right place, the defense don't want disclosure because it's only going to make matters worse.
I mean, I can remember the days, like you, Ian, when some defense solicitors would employ, in some cases, Australian backpackers, actually, to sit in warehouses going through material they didn't understand, didn't know what they're looking for, and they would pay them half of what they could charge, or probably less than half of what they could charge out to the legal aid fund for their services, and that obviously wasn't helping anyone. I mean, I think you're right about technology, and I think it must be the case with developments in AI and intelligent document search that it's going to become easier and easier to manage these sorts of quantities of material through technology, and that probably is a large part of the answer, because that is going to require substantial investment from the government. And I think before we end, Tim, we ought to come on to what we think would be the best and strongest proposals for reform of the SFO. What are the two or three things that would make a difference? I'm sure technology is one of them. I also think, as I intimated earlier in this podcast, that I think offering a wider variety of roles in these agencies, offering the possibility to become a senior advocate rather than farming all the work out to the bar all the time, whilst, as I've said, very unpopular with the bar, would be very useful in terms of recruitment to these agencies. But do you have any particular thoughts beyond that, Ian? I mean, what would you, if there was one single thing that the SFO could do to improve its performance relatively swiftly, what would it be in your view?
Well, I think they need to put together the entire team. So the external counsel, the external accountants, the, if necessary, the external document managers, and the internal lawyers and the internal advocates, if they're going to be using them, as a team right at the outset, and then master the documentary record. You've got to get it in contemporaneous order. I still do cases where the prosecution has not put their own exhibits in contemporaneous order. If they're not in time order, it is impossible to understand what happened. And when you're coming up against a prosecution that hasn't even put the documents in contemporaneous order, you know they do not understand what happened. And you therefore know that you're highly likely to win that case. And I think if you do that and have the team involved right from the start, you've got a very good chance of getting the right case thesis, nailing the disclosure, and the defence therefore will stop pressing for it.
Well, Ian, the one thing that the new director of the SFO does not lack will be external advice about what has gone wrong. The new director took over last month. He's called Nick Efgrave. He is not a lawyer. He is a former senior police officer. And he's the first non-lawyer to hold the post. And he takes over the SFO as a time of, to say it's a time of crisis is perhaps to underestimate it, because the system seems to be in permanent crisis. But anyway, he has the reports from Sir David Calvert-Smith. He's got the Altman report into Uniroyal. He's got our podcast with Claire Montgomery. And now he has your views, and hopefully he'll be listening to them, as will Jonathan Fisher, as he addresses the major issues that he's supposed to do over the next 9 months. Ian, thank you so much for joining us. That's been a fantastically interesting discussion.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
And Ian, Tim mentioned the speed with which the Bankman-Fried case was brought to trial, and I think within a year, Donald Trump may be brought to trial within a year, for all we know. But I just wanted to mention that I gave a piece of advice to the SFO and the FSA, as it then was, jointly on the Barclays case in 2009. And I think it came to trial when?
First time around in 2017, I think. Okay. 2018, maybe.
Okay. Well, there you are. Yeah. I mean, that says it all. And that's a job for the new SFO director, because you simply cannot deliver justice in complex cases on that sort of timescale. Yeah. Ian, thanks very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Double Jeopardy, the Law and Politics podcast, with Tim Owen and me, Ken McDonald. I hope you've enjoyed our conversation with Ian Winter. Please leave us a review, preferably a good one. This helps other people to find us. And please check our back catalogue, which contains conversations with leading luminaries, I should say, from Kathleen Stock to Dominic Grieve to David Panic to Brenda Hale and many, many others. You can find us wherever you listen to your podcasts, and we'll see you soon.
Our editor is Billy Lawrence, and our social media advisor is Jess Jones. We will see you soon.